supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of them jam-packed shows for you, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we're going to be talking about the many faces of honeysuckle, the dreaded invasive one that everybody loves, and the other one, some of which are quite good for your needs and will not get out of control, many of which even have fragrance. We'll also talk about how to do school gardening inside the school year. That's a lot to get done. We'll also talk about teachers learning how to build school gardens that get the most use during the school year. Well, that's a lot to get done. We better get right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Janet, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Janet. How are you?
I'm doing good.
And where is Janet doing good?
I'm in Oklahoma City.
Oh, my goodness. Are you all right?
So far, knock on wood, our house is still standing.
Yeah, I hope everybody's house is still standing, and I hope you're done with those horrid windstorms. I mean, your regular wind is enough to deal with.
Right.
All right, what can we do for Janet still standing, thank you, in Oklahoma City?
My garden, it's probably 10 by 40 foot vegetable garden in the backyard that we've had for 5 or 6 years. And this year, it seems like there's more roly-polies in it than there's been ever been. There's always been some, but there's a million out there now. And I didn't know if they were harmful to the... We have a lot of vegetables. They do eat my strawberries. We have strawberries, and I've noticed that they'll eat my strawberries. But I didn't know if they were going to be a problem with any of our other vegetables.
Right, roly-polies, pill bugs, sow bugs. These are very primitive, ancient, armored creatures. Generally, they are benign. Generally, they are just there eating decayed plant material. Sometimes they do attack young seedlings. Sometimes they are accused of devouring new seeds. If you have injury to your strawberries and you see roly-polies or millipedes or, you know, whatever in there, the smart money says that something else did the original damage and they're being opportunistic like ants.
Okay.
Now, is this area heavily shaded, constantly wet? Because these are creatures of extreme moisture, which I don't associate with Oklahoma City.
We kind of built it around two Chinese pistache trees. So it does get shade, but not all day long.
And do you water this area?
Yes.
How do you water it?
Soaker hoses that I put out there.
Mm-hmm. And when do you run them?
I try not to water them in the evening, so usually it's sometime during the day, maybe first thing in the morning. We both work part-time, so it's not always consistent.
Gotcha. And how many days a week do you run the soaker hoses, and for how long?
We've had rain every week for the last month, and so I haven't turned them on at all yet.
And that's why you got the roly-polies. Their eggs have been in the soil. They've been going through all these dry stretches. They got all this moisture, so they're hatched and out of control. And if there is not enough decayed plant material, enough of their natural food to eat, they could start to get advantageous. There's a very simple cure. As these are creatures of moisture. Obviously, you can't stop it from raining. So there is a very simple organic control you can go out and buy, something we don't talk about much on the show anymore, but this is the perfect situation for it. It's called diatomaceous earth.
Okay.
And sometimes just abbreviated DE. Diatomaceous earth is the mined remains of ancient sea-dwelling creatures, prehistoric creatures, very primitive creatures called diatoms. And if you look those up on Wikipedia, you'll see they looked like elegant little pieces of glass. And so they lived millions of years ago. Those seas receded, everything dried out, and there's mountains of fossilized diatoms. So this material is mined and packaged up, and it looks like flour. It's white. It's a fine powder. You want to be careful not to inhale it. You want to wear a dust mask or make sure the wind is blowing away from you, because even though it feels like flour and a fine powder in our hands, on a microscopic level, it's sharp like millions of little pieces of glass. So you go out and you dust diatomaceous earth around the plants you want to protect. And as long as the diatomaceous earth stays dry, it will desiccate any creature like a slug, a snail, a pill bug, or a sow bug that tries to cross over it. It actually affects many insects. That's probably the easiest answer. But buy a big bag of diatomaceous earth, and that'll protect your strawberries. And if you see big colonies of pill bugs or sow bugs, you can just dust them with the diatomaceous earth and get a big knockdown of their numbers.
All right. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're more than welcome, and you stay safe this summer.
We are trying.
All right. Thank you. Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing very well today, James. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well.
And where is James Well?
I'm calling you from French Creek State Park.
In Pennsylvania?
Yes, sir. In Berks County, not too far from Bucks County.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Jim in French Creek State Park?
I have the good fortune of having pretty much unlimited supply of horse manure from a stable, but among the bedding they use sawdust. And I can remember from a previous show you kind of warning against wood in general in your compost, as it, I believe you said it was a nitrogen thief, but I just wanted to know if it's worth using.
Yes, as long as you use it correctly. Now, when we talk about horse manure, very rarely are we talking about that single object. We're talking about stable sweepings, for probably a more accurate word, which is both the liquid and the solid the animal was done with, captured in bedding, and then shoveled out, broomed out, and then ideally piled up. Now, the things the animal was done with are very rich in nitrogen, so rich that if used directly, they would burn your plants. The bedding tends to be the perfect source of carbon, not so much to neutralize the nitrogen, but to combine with it, and over, depending on the size of the manure pile, over sometimes a very short period of time, cook down and become a rich, black, dirt-like substance that is very friable and has no unpleasant odor whatsoever, and it is very black and rich in color. And that is not compost, but it is composted horse manure, which is kind of a horse of a different color, but it is now ready to use in certain garden situations. That is the perfect food for sweet corn and for lawns. You spread well-composted horse manure on your lawn in the fall, your lawn will get up and kiss you on the lips. You spread composted horse manure between the lanes of your sweet corn rows, you will get fabulous sweet corn. But these are non-fruiting plants. These are plants that only want to grow biomass, which is what nitrogen does. Should you plant your tomatoes in a bed of composted horse manure, you will get the famous 50-foot-tall tomato plant with two tomatoes on it.
Yeah, I've experienced that.
Because that's what happens, is nitrogen grows big plants, but it can actually inhibit the flowering and the fruiting of those plants. So if you've used up all your use for sweet corn, potatoes, lawns, all those nitrogen-only crops, then you take your excess horse manure and you mix it into your real compost, your yard waste compost that was made with mostly shredded fall leaves. You can do this one of two ways. Either when your compost is finished, you can mix in about a third composted horse manure.
Okay.
And now you've got a kind of a balanced fertilizer. Or in the fall, as you're shredding all these leaves and making this massive pile of compost, then you may fork your raw horse manure in with it, and it will still create a balanced fertilizer at the end.
Well, that's good to know.
All right, man?
Thank you much.
All right, good luck,
sir.
Love
the show, even though we have divergent views on lima beans. I can overlook that.
Oh, you're a lima bean lover.
Oh, my, yes.
Well, I'm sorry. We're out of time, Jim. Goodbye.
Thank you. Appreciate the time you did have.
Get out of here.
All righty. Take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who wisely planted garlic back in the fall to be sure and remove any scapes, those little bulges that form on top of the central stalk. Stir fry them up while they're still small to make a delicious garlic flavored vegetable treat. If they get big, drop them into a big jar of apple cider vinegar and let it steep for a few months to make your own garlic vinegar. But don't go reviewing all the details under G in the A to Z Answers section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with how teachers can really have a school garden during the school year. A honeysuckle you can grow that won't have the invasive plant army hunting you down, and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee is dedicated to providing all things needed for planting and growing gardens. Information, instructions, supplies, and more online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, yes, there are honeysuckles you can grow that are fragrant, that are beautiful, that'll cover an ugly fence, and that won't have invasive plant armies hunting you down for growing the dreaded L. japonica. We'll tell you all about them when we get to the question of the week. We'll also take more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our very special guest, Sally McCabe, who is the project manager for the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's Garden Tenders Program and the Green City Teachers Program, which is what she's here to talk to us about today. How to build a school garden. Sally and her friends at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society will be teaching teachers how to build a school garden on Wednesday and Thursday, June 26th and 27th, here in the Philadelphia area at the New Foundations Charter School But of course, we want her to tell us how teachers all across the country can build a school garden, which is a very hot topic right now. Sally McCabe, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. Now, this is a topic that comes up very frequently, and you know I have been often a crotchety old man about the topic of school gardens, because the physical reality, especially here in the Northeast and the Midwest, is that the school year is the polar opposite of the gardening year. To just start with, how do you get around that? How do you create a curriculum, the physical reality of which exists during summer vacation, most of it?
The easiest way to do that is to involve the community, because most of us have a school year that starts in September and it ends in June, and the growing season starts in March and ends in December. So there's a little bit of overlap, but there's a big chunk of time when there's no one at the school. And this is why part of what we work on is having a community, having the neighborhood involved in the school as well, because the kids that live in the neighborhood that go to the school can be coming to the school during the summer, and neighbors can be also maintaining the garden in the summer. But that's not the big chunk of it.
So I'm a teacher. I'm coming into your classroom here to learn how to teach horticulture to my school students. What am I going to learn?
It's not just horticulture. Gardening just goes across so many different subject areas: science, math, art, and horticulture. And what the teachers are very good at is finding ways to make it fit. Getting the kids away from the classroom and out into some fresh air where they can touch some plants and play in the dirt and look at worms and maybe eat a little bit of what they've grown, it just brings out a whole different side of the kids and the teachers.
And most schools have some area of lawn, which I presume.
No. Although there are a lot of schools in the Philly area that do have lawns, too many of the schools are just blacktop. So part of what we teach is how to build a garden on blacktop.
Okay. So right away, that's one of the big issues, because, you know, especially in an urban school, the soil is probably contaminated with lead paint.
Well, we just assume that the soil stinks,
right,
and go from there.
And so you build raised beds.
What we do as the outdoor component of this class that's coming up this month is to learn how to build raised beds and learn how to test soil, learn how to make things grow when you're in terrible, horrible physical makeup that is our schoolyards.
Right. And you've stolen someone's parking spot from.
Oh, yeah. And there's that, too.
And since there's not going to be, theoretically, anybody definitely around over the summer, and we have these raised beds on blacktop in any city, in any, you know, deep heat sink of the city, you actually have a pretty good growing season for things like salad greens and radishes and stuff throughout the school year.
If you set your physical situation up right, you can be growing things. You could plant things in October when the kids are just getting settled into school. You plant your greens and your root crops then, and you can carry them over the winter. So the kids can be actually picking all the way into winter break and then back out again as soon as they get back to school.
Now, this curriculum is very specifically for teachers in the Philadelphia area. We are very lucky to have the Philadelphia Flower Show, which is put on by PHS, the Horticultural Society. And the proceeds from the Flower Show go to fund many wonderful things throughout the city. I know you've built millions of community gardens. You've helped people tend trees. Is there a curriculum that you like or that you can share for teachers in Michigan and South Carolina and Dayton, Ohio?
There are so many different curricula out there, and many of them are good. Our library, the Horticultural Society's library, has put together a whole library guide of different curricula and books and videos and stuff for people to use nationally. But you need to go to someone close. So Michigan would not be coming to Pennsylvania for growing guides. They'd be going to their extension service or their local garden clubs. California, again, California has a, you know, another world altogether out there.
That's a
gimme.
They
don't want to be using our Pennsylvania curriculum.
Right. And you get into the real hardcore places like southern Florida and Arizona, and the growing year is exactly the school year, because what we consider the growing season over the summer, they're all hiding underground in air-conditioned bunkers. So obviously you do have to design a curriculum for your climate. You mentioned the extension services, which are a function of the land-grant universities. Pretty much every state in the country has a dedicated university that has an extension service, and every county should theoretically have an extension agent. Have you seen them getting involved?
Yes, all over the country.
You know, because the extension service was originally formed just to help farmers, and then after that spread out to help homeowners more. So the schools would seem to be a natural progression.
Yes.
So tell us what happens during a typical class. You have a two-day intensive class that you teach here in the Philadelphia area.
It's a two-day intensive. It starts at 8:30 in the morning, runs till 1. And we do a portion of it indoors and a portion outdoors, because we'd like teachers to go home with lesson plans and new ideas. And we make them break into teams, and sometimes we make them do role-playing and acting. But mostly what we're trying to do is to get them to make friends with everybody else in the room, because that's your support group when you walk away. Is you should meet other teachers and see what other teachers are doing, to be introduced to some of this information. I said is available at the library. Where are the good books? What are the curricula that we recommend? What are the websites? Where can you go for that stuff? Get some lesson plans in hand, or ideas for new lessons, ideas for how to take gardening and send it across all the different subject areas. So how do you do math in the garden? How do you do science in the garden? How do you do art in the garden? Get different ideas. And then we go outside and we actually build things. And that's fun. To put hammers and power tools into the hands of teachers is an awesome experience and a little scary.
And do you find that the teachers have the talent, the technique, or are a lot of times are they learning right alongside with the kids?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But hopefully they're a couple steps ahead of the kids. I really enjoy putting power tools in their hands, because that's a side of teaching that we don't get to see. This is a good thing, because I wouldn't want a chainsaw in my son's classroom.
Right.
A bad idea. But to see teachers that teach math, suddenly it's exactly the same with the kids. Kids are trying to do math, but what they really excel in is art. How do we make the math more artistic? How do we make, you know, how do we cross all of these lines so that the teachers and the kids can come out of their normal, comfortable envelope and really shine?
How many schools would you estimate in Philadelphia have established gardens?
Between 300 and 400.
So that's remarkable.
It's remarkable. Some of them are just a token container in front, but it's there. Something is growing. Something is showing that they can do it at a school.
And the students are physically involved.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's that old line from Garrison Keillor, nothing you do with children is ever wasted. And even though it may seem like just a dinky little container to you, when that kid graduates college and gets a house, they may replicate that container exactly on their way to eventually building a giant square foot garden.
We can only wish.
All right. So Sally McCabe will be one of the people teaching how to build a school garden in the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's Green City Teachers Program to train educators. The local classes will be held Wednesday and Thursday, June 26th and 27th at the New Foundations Charter School. And teachers are advised that they must pre-register in advance if they want to do that. And they, of course, they get Act Something credit.
Act 48 credit.
All that kind of good stuff. But teachers from other parts of the country are encouraged to visit PHS online, which we will put a link to at our website, and look at different recommended curriculum and things to help them convince their administration to start playing around with school gardens in their location. All right, Sally, thank you once again for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for having me.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Doug, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am part of a military family. We've grown grass in many different places around the country, but currently we're in St. John's, Florida, which is about 15 miles from St. Augustine, Florida. And my question is about St. Augustine grass. The reason I'm calling is we have different philosophies being proposed around here. One group says to water heavily and deeply several times a week. I know for more northern grasses, I've heard you recommend, long watering once or twice a week so the root system gets deep. But we have basically about 3 or 4 inches of topsoil put down on top of sand. We're in a new homeowners association development. And the sprinklers, when we first moved in, were running about 16,000 gallons a week for less than a tenth of an acre of lawn. And they're pretty much running an hour a day, 5-6 days a week. Neighbors will run it anywhere from twice a week for 2 hours on the grass in the early morning to others say just do 45 minutes a day, 3 or 4 days a week. And so my question is, what is the best way to do it? Because at the moment I've got dollar weed and nutsedge that are invading and driving me crazy.
The interesting thing about your situation is that you have a warm season grass. And obviously you know the difference because you referred that, I tell people to water cool season grasses weekly and deeply. The truth is that that's the best watering regimen for just about every type of grass. St. Augustine really does need weekly watering. It does not need more than that. Deep watering once a week should keep it alive. In extreme situations, which obviously you will get extreme over the summertime, deep watering twice a week might be a good idea, but never more often than that. And a 45-minute watering is like a frustrating date in high school. It just takes so long for the grasses to open up, especially in a hot climate where they're closed up tight to retain their moisture. It takes them so long to realize they're being watered and then start accepting the water that turning it off after 45 minutes is like, hey, wait a minute. Wait, you just got started. What are you doing? So you say that you did mix in a lot of topsoil with your sand.
Well, the developer actually just comes in and sort of lays a few truckloads down on top.
Right.
They don't really till it that I've noticed on the new developments. And then they just throw the grass on top, turn the sprinklers on, and move to the next house.
And do you know what time of year this was done?
Our lawn was put in around September 2 years ago.
Oh, God.
And we moved in about a year ago.
You poor people. I mean, they put northern lawns in the spring. And they all die. And southern lawns should be put in the spring, so they put yours in the fall. And that's one of
the developers.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons your lawn is struggling. It should have been seeded or sprigged or, however it would be installed at the very beginning of warm weather. Your grass was seeded and then went dormant. So it's the worst.
Well, it was all turf sod.
Oh, okay.
Sod squares.
Okay. A sod, that's kind of different, although I guarantee your weed woes would be less if the sod had been installed in the spring. Who cuts your grass?
I do.
And how high do you cut it?
I try and keep it about 3 inches to 4.
St. Augustine grass can tolerate anywhere from 2 to 4 inches. Traditionally, some southern grasses are cut much lower than northern grasses, but yours is the exception. Yours is, you would care for it just the way you're doing. I would think a 3-inch cut would be very good. Who feeds your lawn?
I was doing it myself. We went ahead and went with a service that comes around every 6 weeks, the typical weed and feed in the spring, grubs in the early spring. And they basically have a schedule which seems to follow what most of the local nurseries and guides recommend.
Do you have children?
One question again on the.
Do you have children?
We have three.
Yeah, and you really want these unnecessary chemicals sprayed on your lawn, and then you're going to let the kids run around on it?
Well, it's small enough that most of them don't, there's not much yard for them to run around on. Our activities generally end up being outside the actual local area.
You don't need the herbicides. You don't need the grub killers, especially where you are. What your lawn does need is at least three gentle feedings during the time that it's green. You know, in from the late spring through when it starts to, does it go dormant down there? Or does it stay green over winter?
Depends on the winters. This last one, we had several snaps in it and a few freezes, and it did brown up and go dormant on several people.
And you know,
sometimes it stays green all year.
Right. And you know not to panic if that happens in cold weather. That's perfectly normal.
No, I lived here for 20 years back before we started our military moves.
Yeah. My advice, water first thing in the morning. I would strongly advise you to get rid of the service and just feed your lawn gently, naturally, and organically 3 to 4 times over the course of a summer. Sounds like you're cutting it right. Make sure the blade is nice and sharp. But those long, deep waterings are your best protection against these weeds.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Thank you.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind you that today's guest, Sally McCabe, who we just heard, will be among the instructors who will be learning teachers how to build school gardens when the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's Green City Teachers Program presents an intensive 2-day workshop on Wednesday and Thursday, June 26th and 27th at the New Foundations Charter School in Philadelphia. Pre-registration is required. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with honeysuckles you can live with and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee is dedicated to providing all things needed for planting and growing gardens. Information, instructions, supplies, and more online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to a very intriguing question of the week. Is the honeysuckle of remembered youth, the dreaded L. japonica, the one that all the invasive plant eradicators are after? And if it is there a similar honeysuckle you can grow that'll give you that fragrance and maybe that drop of nectar? We'll tell you what your choices are after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Jackie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Jackie. Where are you?
I'm in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Well, that's not good enough, Jack. We're in Philadelphia, too. What part of Philly are you?
Kensington.
You're in Kensington. All right. What can we do for Jackie in Kensington?
Well, in my row home garden, over the fall and winter months, a group of feral cats who we kind of took a liking to because they had some kittens and tried to help them out once. Well, now there's quite a few of them in there having their way with my garden, using it as their own private litter box. I wanted to know what I could do to keep them away and what I could do to repair the ground that I use for my vegetable garden. I have about 3x6 plots. Three by 6 feet.
Okay. So have you done anything to ensure that these cats and kittens at least get neutered so that this does not become an exponential explosion?
Yeah, we've already, we've been able to trap two of them and had them neutered within the past couple weeks. And we also had them tested to see if they had feline leukemia, which fortunately they didn't.
Oh, excellent. Good for you. Good for you. Now, the danger of cats using garden soil as a litter box is very real, especially feral cats, but even indoor cats can harbor parasites. The danger is most extreme to you when you are actually working in the soil. That's when you're
right.
exposed to the parasites. Not so much in uptake in vegetables. That has never really been shown to happen. But it is very dangerous to work in the soil with bare hands. So, for instance, I have two cats that roam my grounds out in the woods trying to keep the mice and rats and voles down and rabbits. And I know I'm always going to miss protecting my garden beds in one way or another. So it's been a good reason for me to always have gloves. And I just went out and bought three new pair of gloves for myself. And I use batting gloves because for a gardener, gloves are a challenge. You really want to feel what you're doing. But you really need to protect your hands because we always have tiny cuts on our hands for all this stuff to come in on. And batting gloves are great because they fit so tight and they are so protective. So I always have a couple of good clean pair, clean meaning they're not broken or ripped or anything, of batting gloves around. And I feel that's a great layer of protection. The other thing I do is I have a motion-activated sprinkler set up aimed at my garden. I've got about 1,000 square feet of raised beds. These motion-activated sprinklers cover about 1,200 square feet, so they protect not only my raised vegetable beds, but they get back into the raspberry area and chase away birds. And the way they work, you hook them up to your hose, you point them towards the garden, turn the hose on full force, and nothing happens till something breaks the beam. Then the sprinkler head turns and shoots a couple of cups of cold water at them. Well, cats levitate. They go straight up in the air, and then their legs start turning around. It's absolutely hilarious. One other trick that a lot of gardeners have done early in the season when they're planting their garden, getting it ready, they'll buy a roll of chicken wire, and they'll roll chicken wire over top of the beds and staple it down to where it's tight over top of the beds. And then, you know, if you're sowing things directly like bush beans or lettuce or spinach or even sweet corn, you can just sow the seeds into the holes in the chicken wire. If you want to install something like a tomato plant or a pepper plant, use a pair of tin snips to make a little hole and put the plant in through the hole. But cats will not use a bed that is covered with that kind of wire because they have this instinct that they must cover up what they've done, hide the feces to protect the species. So if a cat can't scratch in the soil, they won't use it as a litter box.
Well, it sounds like a lot of good advice, Mike. Thanks a lot. I'm going to try that chicken wire.
It is a very common problem. You calling has helped out a lot of people today.
Okay. Thanks again.
All right. Thank Bye-bye. You, Jackie. Good luck. 1-888-346-9499. Barbara, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Well, I've been waiting to hear your voice, so let's not waste any time.
Okay. I guess I've been told.
I'm calling from beautiful Bucks County.
Right.
I'm on the route right up to Peddler's Village and New Hope out of Central Bucks.
That is a beautiful area.
And for my birthday this year, I got a gardenia bush from California for my son. but it had no directions or instructions. It didn't even have what it is.
Oh, my goodness.
I had to guess because I'd seen gardenia bushes.
Right.
And it's, I guess, in a 12-inch pot, but mostly moss. So it's beginning to show wear and tear. So I was anxious to get in touch with you to see what I should do with it.
We get these calls like once or twice a year of someone giving someone a gardenia as a gift. And I have to be honest, my first thought is, oh, don't they like you?
That doesn't hold true here, of course.
Because it's like the biggest drama queen diva coming to stay with you for a week. You know nothing you do is going to be even vaguely acceptable. They are very finicky plants, and it is unfortunate they really didn't send you the species or the variety name or the cultivar or anything?
Not even the name, but they made the mistake of putting their name on the package, and I noted it, and I'm all ready to rat them out.
Oh, you mean the plant company?
Right.
Oh, okay. No, I think that's an excellent idea. Because he contacted them, and they packaged it up and mailed it off to you.
Yeah, well, they, you know, it's a famous company.
Right. Well, that's fine. That's fine. You don't necessarily have to name them. It could have been just a clerical error during a busy shipping season where they forgot to put the instruction sheet or the plant tag in.
Or the name of the plant.
Right. But in other words, the only reason you knew it was a gardenia was your son said, hey, Mom, watch out for a gardenia coming.
No. I just identified it from seeing the leaves, you know, on previous plants. My brother-in-law had one that was huge, and it did everything he told it to do. And he had loads of blossoms on it all the time.
And is he still around?
He's around. I don't know if the plant is.
No, but I'm saying he is probably going to be your best source of information. I'll give you my book learning, but somebody who has nursed a gardenia successfully for many years, I bow to, and you should call him and ask him for advice. Now, is it your intention to put it outside during the summer and bring it back in the winter?
It's out as we speak.
Okay.
And I thought maybe it was too much inside, that it needed some direct sunshine. Because inside it was getting bright light, but not direct sunlight.
Well, I think that's probably what it likes. Is it in a clay pot or is it in a plastic pot?
It's in a plastic pot.
Okay.
And well, I'm contemplating transplanting it anyway.
Into a bigger pot?
Right.
Okay.
Not terribly bigger, but a little bigger anyway.
They are really finicky. They need a highly acidic soil. So if you are going to repot it, fill in the pot with peat moss and compost. They like a rich soil, but a naturally rich soil. So do get in touch with the plant company. Ask for the variety name that they sent you. They'll have a list and tell them they didn't send you an instruction sheet. Make sure they do. It might be a good idea to pot it up into a bigger pot, get rid of that moss on top. But do fill up the inside of the new pot with peat moss to make the soil acidic, compost to make it naturally rich, and, you know, try to achieve that dappled sunlight, that really bright light, but they can't take direct light. And there's a lot of flowering plants like that. They like it bright, but they can't bake in the afternoon sun. But do that. Make sure the soil's acidic. Make sure it's rich. Don't give it any kind of chemical plant food. And do talk to your brother. If he had success with gardenia, and tell him to call the show. He's probably going to be a lot more help than I can be.
Oh, okay. I will do that.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you very much. Right. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, the many faces of honeysuckle. Alexis Landish, You Bet Your Garden producer, would you read the two questions we've chosen to introduce this topic?
I would be happy to. We heard from Justin in Roxboro, Pennsylvania, who writes, "My wife had a black chain link fence installed to contain our two dogs. I think it looks god-awful and want to cover it with something. My parents have been singing the praises of honeysuckle and just about had me convinced, until one of my coworkers rolled her eyes at me and explained that her honeysuckle had gone berserk and was now strangling all the other plants in her yard. So who's right? We also heard from Karen, who says she's now in Perkasie, Pennsylvania, but she grew up in northern New Jersey in the 1950s. She also has a friend who grew up in eastern Pennsylvania in the 70s. She says, "We both remember a honeysuckle that when you pulled off the flower and sucked the end, you got a drop of nectar. The dreaded L. japonica doesn't look like what we remember, and I don't recall, quote, our honeysuckle as being invasive. I remember the flowers being white and yellow. Do you have any idea which honeysuckle that could be? We both want to plant it."
Well, the honeysuckle genus, Lonicera, is enormous, with 180 naturally occurring species and a dizzying number of hybrids. Most honeysuckles are vines, although a few are shrubs. Most are reliably winter hardy, although a few, like the prized giant Burmese honeysuckle, are purely tropical. Many are fragrant. Some have no scent at all. The flowers can be white, yellow, a combination of white and yellow, or a bright red that is among the best attractors of hummingbirds. Now, the honeysuckle that triggers intense childhood memories of fragrance and flower sucking, and the one that is by far the most invasive member of the family, is L. japonica, the beloved and despised Japanese honeysuckle. Often referred to as Hall's honeysuckle after the most famous cultivar, its flowers open up white, age to yellow, and can contain so much nectar you can get a pretty good sugar rush sucking flowers during the blooming season. If you're overwhelmed by an outdoor fragrance in the summer that's so heady it makes you weak in the knees, it's probably Japanese honeysuckle. And if you have sent me a panicked email or made a frantic phone call about a vine from hell taking over your entire neighborhood, it's probably Japanese honeysuckle. This vine is a rampant grower. Spreads both underground and above ground by shoots tip rooting in the soil and by producing berries that are very attractive to birds who avidly consume and then replant them a while later. Oh, and look, they even fertilize them. Many, if not most, garden writers have a love-hate relationship with this plant, officially despising it while occasionally admitting in private that the fragrance and nectar are unparalleled. In the end, however, it is so invasive that you have to tell people not to plant it. Although you generally don't have to actually plant it to have it. Lady Japonica showed up on my backyard dog fence a decade ago and persists to this day despite my yearly cutting it back. But you can still plant a honeysuckle to cover a fence. Just choose one of the many non-invasive species, some of which are nicely fragrant. Back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, one of our writers, Jeff Cox, explained in an article on flowering vines that the luscious woodbine extolled by Shakespeare in A Midsummer Night's Dream was actually the woodbine honeysuckle, a sweet-smelling European native that is much better behaved than its Asian cousin. There are a large number of named varieties available, all of which are wonderfully ornamental. And in the classic book on the subject, Armitage's Vines and Climbers, University of Georgia professor Alan Armitage recommends Gold Flame, a hybrid honeysuckle whose deep red flowers open to yellow with a scent that is, quote, pleasant, but that will not knock you over. He also likes the Native American Trumpet honeysuckle, whose red tubular flowers are legendary hummingbird magnets. Although some gardeners have reported fragrance from this species, Armitage says no, but he does otherwise highly recommend it as a well-behaved and very ornamental flowering vine. Italian honeysuckle is heavily scented. Its yellow flowers are tinged with pink, and the berries that follow are orange and highly ornamental. Lonicera X Americana, in plant names, an X in the middle defines a hybrid variety, would seem to be at least half native, but it's actually a cross between two European varieties. Go figure. Its heavily scented flowers are yellow flushed with a reddish purple. And that is just the tip of the honeysuckle iceberg. The short answer, as if I could ever deliver a short answer, is that the honeysuckle of remembered youth is probably Japonica, and it is invasive. Armitage, who greatly admires the look and scent, is finally forced to conclude, quote, that there are just too many reasons to stay away from this plant. But that leaves dozens of well-behaved cousins that have intoxicating color and/or fragrance and/or hummingbird attraction for you to choose from. Just pick a well-behaved variety with the attributes you require. And if you should happen to stumble onto a clump of Lady Japonica in full bloom in the woods, feel free to suck all the sweet nectar you want. Just leave the pruners at home. Well, that sure was some hopeful information about having potentially honey-scented, non-invasive vines, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over carefully, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to plant L. Japonica in my shoes if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired report, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject, which is not help or question, in the subject line. And check voice to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems just like yours, oi, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. Listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is WHYY senior engineer Fred Snyder. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Please check out her fine work at our Facebook page and like us. Our well-behaved editor is Al Banks. Our sweet-smelling interns are Jolie Higazi and Cecily Garber. The highly ornamental Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm rampantly invasive, number one on the alien invader hit list, Mike McGrath. And if I can ornamentally escape the spray tanks of the invasive eradicators, I'll see you next week. Are ivy-covered walls sure to tumble before their time? Or could the plants actually be protective? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll look at the pros and cons of ivy-covered buildings. Plus your fabulous phone calls.